Hi, everybody. Welcome to today's episode of No Killing Goblins. I'm in shell shock. What am I saying? Welcome to today's episode of No Killing Goblins. I'm Oshi, and I'm here with Dragonus. How do you say hi, Dragonus?
Hey everybody. Oshi's just a little bit discombobbled. I think we all are. Today is the day that the last episode or the last, well, three chapters, four if you count the epilogue. Anyways, Volume 8 is officially over. Expect a special episode from us, lots of spoilers talking about that one. But yeah, I think we're all just a little speechless right now.
I don't even know what I don't know. I feel like I've just been trampled. Like I don't know how else to say it. It's like pirate drove a train right over me and then went, "Yay, bye." Remember those Roadrunner commercials and when the coyote would try to trap the Roadrunner over the like a railroad or something, and the railroad would go over the coyote and you were flattened. That's me right now.
Like a Looney Tune.
Yeah, like Looney Tunes. I don't even know where to begin with that one. But thankfully that's not what we're here to talk about. Ugh.
Not yet, but we are here to talk about much closer to the beginning of this grand journey. Before we get to that, though, other than wandering in and trains and pancake flattenings, how's your week been?
It was the end of Ramadan, which is Eid al-Fitr, which is really giant holiday. One of the few, like, there's a bunch, but this is one of the few, lots of family get-togethers for me. So I slept for 2 hours and 4 days. There was a lot of cooking, a lot of family, and a lot of shit going on. And I don't even pray that much, but it's like Christmas. You kind of have to do something.
You gotta be there.
That was my week. Yeah, that was my week. How about you?
I did boring things because I don't actually change my stuff up from week to week. I guess most exciting thing I've been doing is I bought a copy of the 5e conversion for Temple of Elemental Evil. It's 800-ish pages, and I have to prep all of them because I want to run it. I'm currently going through and making handwritten notes, trying to figure out what every creature in the module is so I can make sure that I have a mini ready for it. Probably hand painted. Because I've got all these new Duncan Road paints coming to me eventually, and I'd like to use them.
There was a bunch of like shit that went down in media last week. The Met Gala happened, and oh, that wasn't what I was talking about. It was the Do I think Doctor Strange is coming out really soon, right?
The what?
Doctor Strange is coming out, the
Oh
movie.
yeah, that comes out this Thursday or Friday.
Yeah, that's what I was planning to do. It got okay. Basically, this week has been either family stuff or horrible news. That doesn't, not including TWI. Just I don't want to talk about it. If you read the news, you'll know why it's depressing for me. That's all I'll say.
Been a long week.
I don't know where should we start? We kind of had to delay recording too by a few days, so it's our usual recording day, and I am not sure where we should start.
I mean, the best place I think to start is at the beginning. Aaron, confused by flowers.
Ah, we gotta do emails.
Oh yeah, emails. That would be probably a better place to start. Which we're starting to get enough of them in, we'll have to save a few for next week. Coming from D, Donkey Monkey, in the last episode, Flossing Fairies, you mentioned two of what I think are Pabba's greatest strengths as a writer. First, the dreamlike nature of the narration surrounding the Fae. Pabba is really good at the this doesn't feel real type of thing, which, you know, this then goes into some more spoilery weirdness, but I agree. I think that when Pirate wants to create surreality, Pirate does an excellent job creating surreality. And second, Pabba's really good at researching different perspectives and listening to other people when they get something wrong, which Actually, this came in before we had a chance to release MR, but that came up a lot in MR1 and 2.
It's a really fair first thing to say when it comes to that, is that Pabba has a at least attempts Pirate attempts a level of empathy for everything they do, and they work within that level of empathy. So it gives a kind of earnestness and sincerity to their writing that isn't necessarily okay. I was about to say isn't necessarily bad. I don't know why I would say that. I mean, Pirate Abba's sincerity and empathy give their writing depth. It also allows one to feel like you are with somebody who isn't going to judge you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, and I would definitely say like Pirate's good at sort of creating this feeling that they're not being condescending, which some people are just bad at whenever they try and write outside their point of view or tackle a difficult subject.
All right. We have another email from Hubelina. Hey guys, I love your podcast. My fiance and I listen to to you guys on our way to and from work. It always brightens our days. I've also spent a long time putting myself in Relk's shoes and wondering if I would have treated Rags the same way. And I fear I would have treated Rags the same. As a guardsman who is responsible for protecting Lascaur citizens and knowing what we do about Relk's personal history, I think it would be almost impossible to not victimize Rags. Add in the fact that Relk's job is to protect people and goblins are actively attacking and eating travelers to his city. There is no way that Relk hasn't participated in multiple monster hunts to clear out the goblin population. Monster hunts being in quotations. He would have been required to kill not only the tribe's warriors, but also their children, elderly, and infirm. Relk lives in a monolingual world where most people have never even heard of other languages existing. Becoming bilingual fundamentally opens up a person's perspective about what another culture is like. Can you imagine what it would be like to hearing a foreign language for the first time without any concept of what language is? The quote unquote racism, lingualism that people face in our world would be so much worse in the in-world. People likely equate sapience with mutual intelligibility? Throw in his personal history and that his best friend was brutally stabbed to death. I think that asking anyone to not have visceral hatred for goblins would be unrealistic. Aaron's humanizing goblins not only attacks Relk, but also would make him guilty of participating in a people's genocide. I fear that if I was in Relk's shoes, I would actively not try to humanize, draconize them. Even if that meant leaning into my hatred. I love Relk's character not only for who he is, obviously, but for who he becomes. Best regards, Hubelino.
So I gotta want to break this up into two separate thoughts. The first, I actually had not thought before about the issue of the monolingual society that just exists worldwide here, outside of a couple very rare exceptions. And yeah, I can see how that would definitely lead to creating an extra sense of foreignness.
I mean, it's a really interesting point because I hadn't thought about the fact that you're putting a being in place that speaks a different language and looks different from you, and it's such an obvious parallel to the real world where okay, you speak a different language and you one second. Where you, okay, let me start from the beginning. I hadn't really thought about it, but it's an incredibly good point that Hubelina makes. Language is a huge barrier in our world, in the real world, in Earth. People have killed each other over languages. That's the only difference there can be between entire groups who might look exactly the same. Just because you speak a different language, it's a valid way of saying that you are other, and that's enough for an entire people to what be wiped out.
I mean, more than just that, people strongly would associate identity and language in a lot of ways. A lot of the wars in England and France, for example, there was a constant threat, if not perhaps intention, that, they'll make us stop speaking French and they'll outlaw speaking French if we let this English guy be king.
Absolutely. I mean, the Welsh have fought for centuries, and the English apply. Actually, the English are just everywhere to being dicks, but essentially trying to wipe out entire cultures by forcing them to speak one language over another. It's very deeply personal, and it is a unique perspective, at least for me. I don't think anybody's ever mentioned that aspect of it. But yeah, different language. It's there. It's just not something you speak about. It's just part of it, right?
And as for the rest of it, so here's the thing. I understand how Relk gets where he is. I'm not, saying that I don't see how this otherwise fun, easygoing, lovable guy can be such an unrepentant piece of shit in this situation. I'm just saying that he is not the first, nor is he. Well, he probably is the first in the story, but he certainly, I don't think, is much of a spoiler to say be the last person in the position of having been a military man or woman who has had to confront the reality of what this interspecies goblin conflict means. And as reactions go, I still think his is just wrong. I can understand it, but I can't excuse it.
Yeah, okay. That's more than fair enough.
Oh, and our last one today will be from Lanray. And hi, just finished listening to the episode, and whenever the Fae are mentioned with this their strange concept-based magic, I always think of this quote from the late great Terry Pratchett. It's the one I think everybody knows. Elves are wonderful. Elves are marvelous. Elves are terrific. Elves are bad. I think of the same one a lot. They even reference that book in, God, I want to say it was a couple chapters ago.
I feel like you should read the quote.
I don't know if I'm allowed to read that quote and get me sued.
It shouldn't get us sued. It's a quote from Terry Pratchett. We're not exactly.
Fair. All right. Elves are wonderful. They provoke wonder. Elves are marvelous. They cause marvels. Elves are fantastic. They create fantasies. Elves are glamorous. They project glamour. Elves are enchanting. They weave enchantment. Elves are terrific. They beget terror. The thing about words is that the meanings can twist just like a snake. And if you want to find snakes, look for them behind words that have changed their meaning. No one ever said elves are nice. Elves are bad.
Terry Pratchett, lords and ladies.
And on the subject of words that change their meaning, there's a whole different book that he wrote where he has a very funny joke about the way the meaning of nice has changed. Because a nice prophecy doesn't mean a good prophecy. It just means an accurate one.
Yeah, it means an accurate one. It's the entire premise of an entire like book. Terry played a lot with language, and he understood intrinsically that oftentimes modern language and portrayal is based on modern ideals, and we forget that language has changed over hundreds of years, which means what we're reading is one is our interpretation of their interpretation of their opinion, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I will say that I think that as much as the Fae are cruel, mean-spirited, massive, unmitigated pieces of shit assholes, I don't think they're ever quite as malevolent as the Fae in Discworld could get.
No, I mean, let's be real. The way they treat Syria is kind of malevolent.
Oh no, it's mean. It's bad. But like the Fae in Discworld were so like from the ground up mean-spirited and existing in a level of what I can only call pure bad faith. I just don't feel like the Fae in Discworld quite get it there. And To finish this one off, I think Pirate really captures both the marvel and malevolence of the Fae in all their aspects, especially in later stories, which we can't talk in too much detail about. Also, Aaron throwing idea-based dinner parties in for Fae in Book Two, and people say she. Nope, not. We'll cut that one off there.
Yeah, we'll cut that off.
I would have read that one just fine yesterday.
Thank you, Lanray, for the email. I'm sorry we couldn't cover everything you said. It's a really good quote. It's a really good point. Pirate recently wrote in, did you read the author note for the last chapter of Volume 8?
Yes.
Yeah, so Pirate's a giant fan of Terry Pratchett, and this makes so much more sense when you think about how they portray certain things.
I had always just sort of assumed it to be true.
So that's it for emails for today. Thanks everybody for emailing us. Remember, you can always get in touch with us through our contacts. We'd love to hear from people. Thank you to everyone who continually sends out emails, and we really appreciate it, aside from giving us content to talk about.
Yep, and on the subject of just emails, we couldn't get to it, but I wanted to give an extra shout out to Seth just for being awesome.
Yeah, he did a really nice thing for us. We'll talk about it next episode, but yeah, thanks.
That said, back to, I guess, the other best place to start for the episode, Aaron being angry looking at flowers.
Oh my God, that transition, dude. But yeah, Aaron being angry and looking at flowers. Honestly, the flowers surprised the crap out of her, and I should feel bad, but I was giggling.
Even she knows she should have known better, and like, she's God, what's the phrase that I you have she has to respect it, right? The Fae got one over on her. She should have known better. That's life.
I think that's the best part of all this is that it was a gentle kind of trick, right? She did a lot of work and stuff, but she didn't exactly blow through her money or she didn't lose a limb. They certainly didn't trick her into like walking into a bog and then dying alone or something like that, or take away her firstborn child. They just gave her some flowers instead of
Well,
gold.
but yeah, but paying with the flowers instead of giving people real money is a nice classic little trick. And I did not really have time to go into it last episode, but I really Torin here, because Torin knew and Torin could see it, and you can see in this chapter, the more upset she is, the more dejected and frustrated Torin is becoming.
Yeah, but hold on. Before we dig into Torin, though, here's a couple of things that make me really appreciate the way Erin's attitude works. First off, she talks about getting Inn's aura and the Wondrous Fare, and the first thing she says about Wondrous Fare is whether it's like food or bus fare. I can't even, like, what the, that was a joke, Pirate? What? And then she does say something that sort of impressed me. She's talking to Torin after in the morning and stuff, and she says, "Oh right, turn bad things into good things." And they ha gave me something, even if it wasn't what I thought. Fairy gifts. Okay. Her immediate reaction to a setback is to try to find the good or use what she's got to do something more. It's industrious. It's very Christian. I appreciated it. It's much more practical, and I appreciate the practical attitude to bad stuff happening.
Same, and ultimately it's taking the trick that the fairies have played on her, and in some ways kind of playing a trick on them, because what they think is a worthless gift might not be as worthless after all, as she goes to nibble on one, and then proceeds to have probably the funniest moment for me in this whole book.
Not the funniest moment for me in the whole book, but certainly a reminder that Pirate Abba does like their fantasy, and Erin shrinks. She turns into Alice.
Aaron thinks she shrinks.
Oh yeah, no, she shrinks. It's totally believable. It's not like she got high or Possibly
Well, like
started an acid trip.
you see it from Tord's perspective, though, that Erin just flails out of her chair, thinking that she's shrinking on the ground, panicking. Just something about everything about it is pure comedy gold. Torin is confused. Erin is panicking. Not Erin's a moron. And Torin's just Torin is catching the bad end of it all around.
Okay, two things about this entire endeavor though. One, pirate clearly has never gotten high. Because that shit worked way too fast. I mean, you lick a flower and you're suddenly so high that you think you shrank?
Well,
No.
first off, they're magical flowers, and I don't even think so much that she tripped out in the getting high sense. She was under the specific effect of an illusion, believing that she had been shrunk like the Alice in Wonderland thing.
Sure, but I just mean, like, if you know what it's like to get high, you'll know that it's one of those things where, depending on what you're having, it can lull you. It's an upper or a downer, so either slowly like drop into it, or you sort of rush headlong.
The question of uppers and downers gets a bit more complicated when talking about drugs that involve a degree of disassociativeness like acid. And honestly, it's a whole separate thing. I don't think this is entirely really analogous to getting high, at least not as it's being done at the moment.
I thought it was very much getting high, but yeah, sure, why not?
I mean, it has some similar humor to it, but like the actual mechanics don't match up for me. And it takes a really funny moment to really add some bright levity to what is, after this, an absolute motherfucker of a chapter.
Yeah, it's we finally deal with the aftermath of what happened to Kershia?
Kershaya?
Yeah, I'm sorry. We finally deal with what happens in the aftermath of having Kershia's stall blown up by this mysterious young woman who just took away what we find out is a lifetime of work and is such a significant moment. Thing. She hints at the fact that it's significant to the others. There's talk between her different Nalls about it. There was clearly something there that is irreplaceable that was destroyed.
And may not just set her back, but set back her whole tribe.
Yeah, and it's horrifying. There was a section, there's a moment in this chapter where I had to like think about it for a moment. I didn't know if Krisha would be as empathetic as I hoped she would be. She's spent the last book and some odd chapters being this kind of careful, motherly, sisterly figure, and now she's in this and moments of disaster is when you're tested that attitude that kindness is tested. Are you still kind in the end, or are you?
I'll have to say, I don't know if I think that's a fair axis to judge Kershaya in this chapter on. So here's the thing. Culturally speaking, there's no easy analog that you can point to for gnolls. They are a very unique, really cool, they have their own thing. We find out more as we go. But one thing I think we can definitively say about gnollish culture is that they don't take. What's the word? They don't, and I wouldn't even want to say insults because this is way beyond an insult. Like, no, gnolls are a very eye for an eye kind of people.
Well, no, I think that's Drake's. Gnolls are more
Actually, you're right, gnolls are probably more disproportionate, like arm for an eye or leg for a hand.
I suppose that's one way to look at it. I thought of it as gnolls are more like when they are hurt, when you hurt one of us, you hurt all of us, and we're gonna come for you.
Also true. But regardless, it's interesting to me. given the severe personal blow she's been dealt by this person, I don't think it's fair to judge, how kind or empathetic she's being when she's actively the victim in this situation.
Yeah, and she's so depressed. And she talks a lot about, or at least she thinks about the fact that I don't have anything to give anymore. And she was putting all of her hope on Aaron and sort of not praying, but at the same time hoping that Aaron could give her some bit of knowledge to replace all the things she'd lost, a process, some bit of information, something. And she was actively questioning whether or not Aaron would be just like this human who burned her home. Sorry, her work. Like it was a pretty shocking, significant moment, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, she's in deep pain, and I don't know, I just don't. I sometimes think that the, X is when you see a person's true color stuff sounds great on paper, but often ignores that people can often sometimes be at, in fact, absolutely not themselves after something like this.
I mean, she starts. Okay. We kind of glossed over it, but the treasure that was hidden beneath Krisha's stall was 23 magical books, a rare collection of books to teach magic. And they were the sum of the efforts of the Silverfang tribe over these long years. All of it was gone in an instant when whoever it was used the magical fire on it. And they're trying to bring this together to give to someone, and it's like, wait, does the chapter talk about it? Was it?
I don't think it specifically mentions the newt, just that it was important to their tribe to have them as a gift.
Yeah, so we'll leave that out. I'm gonna just make this. Okay, so we'll just leave that point out. I clapped. I gotta learn. We gotta remember to do that. If we want something cut, we gotta like clap so that there's like a signal point.
I think that there probably is a way to mark stuff. Well, we'll worry about it later. But beyond just the specific damage done to the gnolls and this, gift of clear importance but unclear purpose, is the way in which Lyskor's justice is complicated. Like, personally speaking, I think execution for this would be wild overkill, but that's probably what it flat just would have been, if it hadn't been for the fear that this strangely well-dressed human person might be a noble. So we'll split the difference and throw her outside in the freezing cold without any equipment or,
Yeah, she's given. Okay, there's like there used to be old laws that if you broke them, you were condemned to death by exposure. This is very close to it.
Yeah, it's very cruel, and I realize that across history, things like the death penalty specifically are one, a hot button subject, and two, used to be much more applicable to stuff like property damage, in part because damage enough to a person's property could just lead to them and their family starving to death and could be tantamount to murder. You take a person's livelihood away, their whole family starves. Lyskor, as a society, feels like it should at least be better than this.
Maybe. I don't want to get bogged down in this because we've got a lot to cover. We've got three important points. Yeah, we have a lot to talk about. So before we get to the big main Aaron-centric aspects of it, we do cover two other things. The first being a perspective of the Hive. We get to see the Free Antinium, sorry, the Queen of the Free Antinium, Kissimver and Kilvickich discussing stuff that's going on, especially the individuals who are arising from their experiments in trying to create something new in the Antinium. And they talk about the attrition rate in that creation process and casually talk about the death of, I can't even fathom how many Antinium in the creation of individuals who go aberrant, who become aberration, and then Kilbekich and Kissimber have to murder. Like, it's such a casual thing, and it's just so horrifying.
And once again, though, it reaffirms as the second time that we get this sort of story beat in the chapter that Eren is important and that Eren is bringing change and that these people are pinning their hopes on Eren.
Yeah. And then there is a distinct point where we get into the headspace of the queen. She talks about how she's leaving the above world to Kzimver and Killivagich because she has to focus on the below world, specifically the threat from the dungeon. And she talks about how the new Antimnium level far, are qu quicker than Killivagich or the queen, and that she needed help because it was all she could do, or all they could do, to hold the line some of the days. Like, it was that hard. And there are 52 workers and 86 soldiers slain, and 5 tunnels breached, and so many places that are like, there's a level of desperation. It was hard to read.
And also a deep level of deception because they're not telling anyone about this. How long has this been going on, maybe?
You have to wonder, but it's kind of like they're under perpetual siege from this dungeon, which is why are they staying there? Why haven't they told anyone what is going on with this dungeon? Why is it attacking them? Are they trying something here? What the hell's going on? It was a bit of a revelation for me.
Very mysterious.
Yes, we know what happens. So once we cover the Antinium, then the next drop, there is a section that also has Magnolia show up, right? And Magnolia is talking. Let me just remind myself. Hold on. I'll
Well,
start over on that one.
Falls finishes delivering Ryoka's message to Magnolia.
That was what it was. Yeah.
And Magnolia is
No, it's not Falls. It's Val.
Val, I get them mixed up. Val finishes delivering that message up to Magnolia, who is quite mysteriously uninterested in Ryoka anymore and has guests.
Yeah. And she does like the message to Magnolia from Ryoka is we should talk soon, Ar. It's just and Magnolia laughs at the message because it's such a in she's smart enough to realize exactly what Ryoka's doing and is like
Leaves Ryoka on red.
exactly.
Magnolia has perhaps found a way to get milk from some other cows and no longer needs to worry about Ryoka, to mix my metaphors.
I can't even like fathom why Ryoka continues to think that she's. You know what? We've bashed on Ryoka enough. Let's leave it at
Well,
that. So
no,
Magnolia gets a.
it was a good plan from Ryoka. It ran into like outside context that Ryoka could maybe have predicted, but wasn't likely.
Yeah, it's like anyway, but the biggest thing that happens in this chapter from an Eren perspective is when she tells people that she's from Earth. Casually says, I mean, it isn't that big a deal, right? There's no way back, not that I know of, and Ryoka and I don't know anything special. I mean, technology is really different from where I come from, but I can't build anything like Ryoka's iPhone. And it's, she tells Syria, and Pisces figures it out.
Yeah. And I mean she has to confide in people. She can't not. I feel like if nothing else, she has picked a person who is trustworthy and worth confiding in this area.
I get, yes, that's true. But it's a moment. I mean, she doesn't go into a ton of detail. She does share this thing. She's sharing it, and it's a big deal. I just thought it was a big deal. It's just such done in a weirdly casual way too. And then tying back, Pisces goes to Selous and tries to become a bronze rank adventurer. And we find out about two things. One, Selous, it has a level of compassion that clearly shows why Eren and she get along, because she secretly has she helps Pisces become a bronze rank adventurer, And then she has Pisces go tell Eren about the girl who's in the snow and about to die because she knows that Eren will help her.
Yep, in fact, that was her price for stamping that paperwork.
I love
But
Sela so much.
as story beats go, though, I noticed that in she does not say it outright the way everybody else does, but it's three separate times over the course of this chapter that people comment, whether directly or indirectly, more in indirectly in Celis's case, about Eren's importance, uniqueness, and ability to sort of get what they want done but can't do themselves. Three times this chapter.
And I think that it maybe it's a little repetitive, but it's a establishing something that becomes important, especially for Eren, is that she's able to break social norms and look at things in just a different enough way that she can punch through problems, sometimes very literally.
Oh, it's, I think, a good storytelling technique to sort of reiterate it three times in three separate contexts, to just sort of show us, to sort of show us Eren and her place in sort of this rapidly changing and establishing status quo in the second book, where her inn's blown up, now her inn's back. She's been doing a lot of day-to-day struggle. Day-to-day problems. This is moving her into the world of what's the week to week, the month to month. What is her place in this setting when it's not on fire and the undead aren't at the door?
Yep. Excuse
And
me.
apparently that place is, despite Saria, was it Saria that tried to kind of talk her out of it?
Yes, Syria was the one who tried to talk
Which,
her out of it.
you know, this feels so strange from Syria, but.
I mean, it's not because Syria is a very practical person. And she has a bitter level of understanding of what people will do to you if you are not the same as everyone else and you choose to help somebody who's not the same as everybody else. She's a half elf. But that's not even the most fun part. This is the beginnings of Syria convincing Pisces to work with her and of Yolong.
Yep. This
And.
is the beginning of something beautiful.
She reforms the Horns of Hammerid, or is trying to reform the Horns of Hammerid, and she invites Pisces to join them. And E, oh my God.
Oh, wow. Sorry. We'll need to edit this, but I just thought about something from Chapter 8 and I'm actually tearing up a little. All right, I'm good.
So much happens plot-wise in this chapter. I think this is the first time Pirate also chooses to do multiple perspectives on this level. We're talking about six different perspectives.
Yeah, this is really where it starts to split up, and like Pirate is kind of stretching their muscles at telling sort of the story from a lot of different perspectives, which is something that like they only get better at, and I think greatly improves the story. On the subject of things that greatly improve the story, is you got it's just the end of this chapter has a perfect, what I'm gonna call next chapter now vibes. Later that evening in Liscor, two teams of Goldrake adventurers entered the city to the excitement of no one but Celis, and a named adventurer began her slow journey as she sailed across the seas from Tyrandria. And Eren fired her first employee. I mean,
Fired?
sorry, and Eren hired her first employee. That turned out to be a mistake. Wait, who's
Was
that
a
named adventurer?
Gazi.
From Tyrandria? Ghazi was already.
Oh wait, no, you're right. It isn't Gazi. Who the fuck was the named adventurer?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of who came over from Tyrandria.
Or was Gazi traveling from Toronto? I
No,
can't
Ghazi was
remember.
already in Chandra. We just did Floss last chapter. She's there.
I think we just hit an inconsistency because I'm pretty sure this is supposed to be Gazi.
No. Well, anyways, a named adventure began her slow journey as she sailed across the seas from Tyrandria. I'm gonna have to try and look up who this is now, or
I
somebody
don't
can send me an
remember.
email calling me a moron. Bonus
Yeah,
points if you
please do.
say it in like a Pisces voice.
Yeah. Pirates author notes talk about how this is the longest chapter they've ever written, and holy flying raisin pancakes, they need to reduce their word count. Before someone points out that longer does not always equal better. There's some conversation about switching magical cooking out for wondrous fare, and the intent, and there are finally multiple perspectives. Did it work? Did it not? I think it worked, right?
Yeah, no, I liked it.
It's such a di somehow it's such a giant thing in web serials, or at least lit game lit stuff, to have multiple perspectives because people suck at writing more than one perspective.
Yeah, and also, like, part of the thing about a lot of gamelit stuff is it usually leans in towards isekai, and one of the things that makes isekai good for both new writers and easy to access for audiences is the outsider perspective from the main character who is be having a world they're not from explained to them. It can be really hard if you're leaning on that as a crutch to then get into the head of a local for more than, like, a paragraph or a chapter.
I loved one of the comments. So they're indeed not, who was the one who pointed out the issue with magical cooking. Note something. Those flowers are interesting since her clothes shrank with her. Would a magnifying glass do the same? Given that she was smaller than a finger is about an inch long, and a human is about 70 inches long. We can say that any significant magnification generated by a lens would be multiplied 70 times. What if she tried to move through a small aperture? How do sensations map from one body to another? So many questions, hacks and exploits. Someone corrects them and says she didn't shrink, she only thought she shrank. And then indeed responds with right, but her perception of her shrinking allows her to see things magnified. If she brought a magnifying glass, some scientists could do some intense research. The point being that he's correct that the flowers changed her perception, and I wondered if it was a truthful perception because the fae don't lie, and probably their objects don't lie either. Does that mean that Aaron could have like licked a flower, shrank down, and actually like had that level of perception to be able to see things on that small, tiny level, and I wondered what that means in terms of perspective. And the fun comment for this is what when somebody responds with saying what you're saying is like scientists should take acid to better see the results of an experiment. And let me tell you, honey, scientists do take acid, and they do write their fucking journal articles with it.
Write the journal articles about
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've seen intellectuals be high on mushrooms and write papers. Like, I don't know how they do it, but they do it.
Ready for the next chapter?
Do you have anything else for comment wise? Okay, I got it. Actually, do you want to wrap up and just, I hate saying this, but I'd rather be happier with one chapter because this was such a big one and I kind of want to talk about the plot significance a little bit more.
Yeah, if you want to, we can do just one.
I really, because this is not a small thing. Like, this chapter was such a huge. Okay, you know what? I'm wrong. Let's just do the second chapter. That's fine. All right, moving on to the next chapter, we have we didn't even talk about it. It was but that last one was 2.23. I can't believe we didn't announce the name of it. That was 2.23. This is 2.24T, all from Torin's perspective.
Go from a lot of perspectives to one perspective. And Torin is so. God, I feel so bad for Torin in this.
I would, but honestly, it's like, how do you feel bad for someone who isn't really quite a person yet? They're growing into a person. It just sucks that people don't notice that they're growing, but He fights a snow golem. That's what the he fights a bunch of
Yeah,
stuff.
he punked Frosty the Snowman like a bitch.
I do appreciate, though, that Pyra chose to introduce Leonette through Torrin's perspective. Leonette being the girl that Eren saves from certain death and then hires.
Unfortunately.
Actually, oh shit, I shouldn't have said her name. You know what? It's fine.
Yeah, no, her name is not a terrible, difficult spoiler. She says it often enough
Yeah.
when she has a chance. But I don't know how you can't feel sorry for Torrin. So I'm gonna go ahead and say, much like how the Antinium are all already individual people, and I have said this for a long time, and I will stand by it till I die, they aren't becoming individuals. They just are, from birth to death, given no opportunity to express it and driven insane by the possibility when they get the chance. I think Torrin was a person pretty much from day one. He was effectively a blank slate of a person. He was given very little guidance, and now he's at the pull wings off a fly stage of things, or porns off of a chorus deer, as the case may be in this chapter.
Yeah, there's a level of. I don't know how good Pirate is, but there is a level of childhood perspective that's there. When you're, I think between two and three, you have no concept of other. You have the people who take care of you and everything else. And everything else is kind of hazy and it doesn't really matter. It's just something you explore. And there's been books written about how 2-year-olds are very close to sociopathy, in that they just cannot fathom the existence of other people. And that's because you just don't have the maturity and understanding of the world or enough knowledge to form that kind of connection to the rest of the
In
world.
a lot of ways, 2-year-olds barely even have what you might call a real sense of self either. I think, though, with Torrin, it is specifically complicated by the fact that his positive feedback mechanisms, the ways in which the people in the world and the world itself are telling him you're doing good or you're doing bad, is what Eren says, and Eren is kind of unpleasable and mean to him. She is a bad mother. Go away, stop being creepy. You don't say that too soon.
Right. Yep.
And
So
leveling.
there is also, I mean, this chapter also establishes some of the dynamics between Torrin and Leonette that become important, in that Torrin clearly does not like Leonette. And are under no circumstances does Torrin like Leonette. And he starts acting like a 2-year-old would and sort of tortures her a little bit.
He pokes her. He's definitely mean. I'm definitely trying to hold it in because people are going to meet Leonette properly next chapter. I don't think they'll like her much either.
That's true, but it's easy to gloss over this aspect of it. Pirate does a very good job of setting it up as a humorous thing, but you have to think about it, the fact if a living skeleton with like that scares the crap out of you, everybody keeps poking you.
Oh yeah, she'd
I
be
mean,
entirely in her rights to be utterly terrified of him.
yeah, and she, I mean, living under perpetual terror on that level is kind of torturous. Yep. I also love that there's this line where Torrin goes, "What was Torrin supposed to do?" He agonized over the problem. He couldn't kill the girl. He even had orders to protect her and show her the ropes, which sadly didn't mean hang or garrote her either. Like, this, it's so cute. He's planning to murder another human being.
Well, he has just no real context for the world, and once again, Eren gives him no guidance, and the system gives him the guidance that violence gives you levels, and levels give you a stronger sense of self, therefore, I will commit violence to become complete.
He
It
needs to
is.
protect. Go ahead.
What? Sorry?
No, go ahead. I have, yeah.
It is an unfortunate situation.
It is. This chapter also introduces a pretty significant group of characters. Halric arrives. All I got is Halric arrives with his team. Hey, Halric is. I mean, okay, let me start that over. This chapter also establishes one of the more important groups that Eren will meet, Halric. Specifically, Halric comes with his gold rank team, and they talk a lot about the different folks that are in Lascaur, and you meet Ulrin, Halric, and Revy, and Tefenis. These four are this really cool group of adventurers that encounter Torin and then, blow Torin up or something, whatnot. But in that moment, you find out how a high-level group of adventurers work and their skills and their classes and a little bit about how they function, right?
Yeah, and we also get a very cool, very slick, fast fight scene. We get to see that Torin showing off that he is growing in more ways than just as a person. He even manages to take out one of Revy's summons.
Yeah, and they don't expect that. And then he does get taken out, quote unquote, and he lies in the snow, falls asleep, and then levels up into a skeleton knight. I thought this was bullshit.
Why would it be bullshit?
Because he becomes a skeleton knight, and some part of me is was okay. I'm going back to, please bear with me, I'm going back to my old perspective. At this point, I was letting go of my, I've told you my theory
Oh,
before that I thought,
the theory.
yeah, so I thought Torin would grow flesh or something and would become like a knight, quote unquote, not a skeleton knight. So this is when I started letting go of the theory of Torin becoming a like a living person. One, because this perspective shows you that Torin is very much a child, and that was just super creepy. And two, it just the level ups clearly gave them the similar path, but they didn't go, go down that super intelligent mode, right?
I get what you're saying. And I don't know, for me, the only thing about it that annoys me is that I don't know what he's done to be to earn a knighthood. I don't know why he's a skeleton knight and not just a skeleton warrior, but it might have something to do with the fact that he was charged to follow Eren, and Eren, metaphorically could be considered his lady and he's the bodyguard. You know what? It's weird, but it's cool. He gets some really slick skills out of it.
Mirage Cut, which is pretty fucking cool.
Torin himself even questions some of the like skeleton warrior versus knight versus is he a knight now?
Well, there is that aspect of it in that he has been given the mission to protect Eren, and that's what he spends his time trying to do, and it's very knight-like, right? He keeps his vow.
That's sort of how it sort of draws us into the end of the chapter too, because yeah, it's not a big, it's not a deep one. This is very much, I feel like, a little character study for Torin specifically. We get introduced some side characters. I mean, they're adventurers. We know they'll be important. They're gold rank even. Leonette gets her first little introduction moment. And then, Torin hears Eren sounding like she's in danger, and by golly, he's gonna protect her.
So Pirate's note is interesting because in the middle of the note they say, with that said, this chapter's chronologically different than the others. But I think it's okay. Let me know. I'm sorry I didn't post this right after whatever. Post it after work, whatnot. But Pirate actually thinks about chronology, and I'm like, what?
Well, yeah, this one sort of took place overlapping with the end of the last one, but also some of the next one, and it's very different. I like it. It's something Pirate doesn't do like very often because it can be hard to keep track of, but fun little experiment.
Yeah, and someone mentioned something, a Richard Davis post. I enjoyed it. The fight scenes were interesting, not amazing. I think because Tor doesn't yet have enough individuality for his heartfelt emotions to drive and add significance to the fight, but still engaging. What was yet more interesting was the threat that Tor might be becoming evil. Killing goblins equal murder, killing fleeing deer equal loveless, and is he torturing the princess? Excuse me. sorry. And or ceasing to like. And or ceasing to like esteem Aaron, Torin being the one dude she doesn't seem to treat all that kindly. Of course, I hope something stops his progression or redeems him, but the danger is clear. Holy crap, dude picked up on all of it. So, pirate, yeah, you just did it, pirate.
And I mean, below that, we get a microcosm of just the killing goblins conversation itself, because apparently that can never be escaped. And oh, readers, I promise you, if you're reading along with us, it can never be escaped.
It is one of the central premises of Aaron. Oh my god, I really
And
want to
people
talk
really
about.
like to hear their voices about it.
Yeah, I really, really want to talk about something, but it's such a spoiler. It's all about Aaron, and it comes back to this. We can't talk about it, but okay, so that was the two chapters we were supposed to cover today. One very quick, and one very not quick and significant. I kind of like the first one better than the second one, because I'm not a Torin person, but I mean, we got to learn more about Torin, and it was very Pirate Abba flexing and showing that they could do complex multi-POV chapters and singular, light, yet thematically significant chapters at the same time.
Yep.
I thought it was a good juxtaposition, right?
I do want to make one comment about something Pirate said in the comments for this chapter.
What did Pirate say?
Well, somebody was talking about how chorus deer were pretty smart. They used their horns in a, like, very tactical way that makes it feel like it's a part of their biology that they're evolved to use. They, you know, created the windborne fog bank. Pirate responds to this thread by saying, if they existed in our world, we wouldn't need dry ice. Instead, all your favorite pop stars would appear in a mist made by an ill-tempered, defecating deer with soldering irons for horns.
They live in a place with deer, don't they? They
moose.
Have to.
They live in a place with moose.
Okay.
Actually, frankly, if you told me I had to put money between a fight between a chorus deer and a moose, I'm probably still picking the moose.
I am definitely picking the moose. I've seen those bastards do. Okay, we're not going to.
Have I
not
ever
go
told.
There, like.
I don't know if I've mentioned it on the podcast before, the first time I ever saw a moose up in Canada, where I was canoeing, and I see this moose in the water, and I'm like, oh, it's a moose. It must be swimming across. I'm like, oh, no, it's walking across. I guess this isn't as deep as we thought we were. And then slowly but surely, I see the moose start getting out on the other bank as we pass it by. And there just keeps being more moose. And then I look down, like, I have to check this. I take the paddle, I take pretty much my whole arm, I put it all the way. I can just about barely scrape the bottom. I look back over. There is still more moose coming out. I look at my dad and I say, okay, let's swing left a little. And he agrees, and we just took a little bit of an extra wide detour around the fucker, because they're big.
They're so big. There's a reason why they use moose horns as like a fertility symbol. Those things are huge. Creatures.
I have heard stories about how, you know, usually, generally speaking, if an animal comes out in front of you while you're driving, you generally should not brake. At least you should not go for, like, the full bore, slam the brakes, screech, somebody might rear-end you, you might lose control. Functionally speaking, Bambi is not as important as you and everybody else on the road.
Right?
This is not true of moose, and I actually got this lesson told to me when I was truck driving from a story about a time an 18-wheeler hit a moose, killed the driver, and then the moose got up and left. They didn't find it.
That does happen. I mean, statistically, you can. Okay, let's not go.
We live
deep
in a world of
in.
Monsters and moose, and frankly, the moose scare me more.
Pirate does mention say something else that was a little interesting that I completely forgot about. But Pirate says in a comment, talking about the geography of the area, Pirate Abba says there's a space between the Bloodfields and the Floodplains gates. Those are just the geographical landmarks of a specific area. Again, a map, I think, is becoming more important. Pirate, give us a map! Give us a map. I want a map. I want a big, big, giant, stylized map that they sell somewhere that I can buy and slap on my walls like we do with Critical Role and shit. But yeah, so those were the two chapters. Do we have a question for our listeners before we go?
I have a question for our listeners. Why are you afraid of the noble and majestic moose? And yes, you are afraid of the noble and majestic moose. I'm actually struggling to think of a good question this time around.
I kind of have one. So having read the multi POV versus the singular POV chapters, what do you guys think? Do you prefer when Pirate dives into multiple POVs, and how they handle it versus singular POVs? Do you feel like there's enough thematic connection between the POVs? Does Pirate handle it well? I know a lot of readers are also like further along in the books, but even now, it's still a big debate, right?
Yeah, true. And I mean, sometimes it's more elegantly handled than others. I really liked it in this set of chapters because of that central theming of people reacting, but also every conversation revolved around Eren to a degree and was narratively reinforcing a point.
Oh, and for a fun thing, if you smelled some fairy flowers and got super high, and you experienced the Alice in Wonderland thing, what would your reaction be like? What do you think? Let's think that about, like, maybe you didn't get shrunk, maybe you got bigger. Would you check out? Well, let's see. What would you do? I'll tell you what happened with me next time when we read the responses.
All right, well, thank you for listening, everybody. It has been another wonderful week.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins. The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at NoKillingGoblin or email us at NoKillingGoblins with an S at gmail.com.